ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi there, Selena Green bringing you The Country Hour today. In a moment, let's talk about the phase-out of live sheep export. Now, some forums are being held in South Australia in the coming week for those in the industry to share their concerns. If you'd like to share yours with me today, 1300 222 891 or the text line 0467 922 891. More on that in just a sec. Also, what if there was a much easier way to count and check your livestock without having to even enter the paddock? Well, turns out there is, and an Australian is developing it.
My dad works has a farm up in New South Wales, and I was up there one day taking some photos with a drone. He's in his mid-80s. He looked over my shoulder and said, you know, if you could check the sheep for me with that, I could stay on the farm longer.
More on that to come in this next half an hour as well. But first today, federal government has proposed a ban on live sheep export, and producers around the country are concerned about what that is going to mean for their industry. But now the federal opposition is hitting the road, coming to South Australia and Western Australia to hold some meetings next week to hear from those who will be impacted and report those thoughts back to Canberra. Heading this up is the chair of the Coalition's Agricultural Policy Committee, Rowan Ramsay, and he's on the line now. Thank you very much for joining me.
Ah, good to be with you, Selena. Thanks a lot for talking to me.
Now, I know that live export, it's a pretty emotive issue and a very pertinent one at the moment. I guess just to clarify where the opposition's standpoint is on the proposed phase-out of live export, it is something that that the Coalition is officially opposed to?
Yes, as is the National Farmers Federation, just about every farming organisation in Australia, I must say, and news has been feeding back to us, particularly from WA, about the deep concerns there. And people are making decisions to quit the livestock industry as we speak, virtually. There's been a destocking, somewhat destocking in Western Australia. It's filled with uncertainty, and that instability in the market, we're very confident, has bled into SA and beyond. It is having effect on markets. We've seen some very low prices in the last 6 or 8 months, maybe a bit longer. But it's a bit up and down, a bit of recovery, but it's fairly depressed again at the moment. And there doesn't seem to be any good reason for it. This industry has turned itself inside out. We've got lower stocking rates, we've got ventilation, our mortality rates now are virtually down with the level of shearing. And like we had those livestock that were actually on the boat there for an extra 2.5 weeks just recently, and they come off in fine condition. So it's showing we can do this. We are doing it well. We've got the ECAS system, which tracks our stock, makes sure they're not slaughtered that they are slaughtered in an appropriate manner and facilities overseas. We are world leading. There is no good reason to shut this industry down.
So you're about to head out on the road and do a number of forums here in South Australia, but also in Western Australia on this. So why are you doing these forums? What are you expecting to get from these?
Well, the government's not going out and talking to growers. I chair the Ag, Water and Environment Policy Committee in the Coalition, and we've decided that we're going to go on the road and hear the industry on these issues and bring their case back to Canberra. We're having one meeting in Adelaide next week, March the 5th, at the Wabil Showgrounds in the Gorda Pavilion. And we're obviously encouraging anyone with an interest in this to come along and have their say. I'm expecting 5 members of my committee to attend, and I'm bringing in, arranging for Steve Bolt, who is one of the leading growers and campaigners on this issue in Western Australia, to come in and brief us on the situation there. And then the next day, that night, we fly to Perth, and then we've got 3 days. I think we've got 6 or 7 meetings across the agricultural regions of Perth over those next 3 days, hoping to get a look at a ship while it's loading with a bit of luck, and trying to get some attention on this issue, The government sent a committee to West Australia to advise on how to phase this industry out and promised we would see the results of those findings. They didn't go there to find out if they should, just when and how. That report is now 4 months old and hasn't seen the light of day outside the minister's office. So we're pretty concerned about the whole affair, and we're just trying to get focus on it, following pressure from grower groups.
You mentioned there the issue with the ship and the Bahija. We saw the issue there with that boat being turned around and some of the complications. If it does seem also now that this is an inevitability and this is the government's policy to go through this, should the focus now be on a process of preparing the industry to investing and looking at the other supply chains within the local market?
Well, look, I don't think it's as simple as that. I mean, we know the Australian supply of livestock is irregular, owing to seasonal conditions. We have droughts, we have floods. We had a huge restocking program going through Eastern Australia following drought and then flood over the last couple of years. Those things are predictable in so much as we know they're going to happen, but they're certainly unpredictable in the short term. And it's probably, we really struggle to have that capacity to meet full dispatch when we have this overload of the system, if you like. We also have the problem in Australia of actually finding Australians who want to work in abattoirs on slaughter lines. We've got a lot of imported labour there, but that's patchy and spasmodic around the way that we can actually supply a workforce for that. It's not feasible that we build a heap of meat processing plants that sit idle for a couple of years in a row while stock supplies are down and we're having a national herd rebuild. So it makes sense that we have this safety valve, a secondary market, something to put a bottom in the market that we can turn off and on as required. I just don't think it's as simple as that.
Ron Ramsey, thank you very much for joining us on the Country Hour this afternoon.
Well, thanks very much, Selena, and I look forward to seeing a good turnout of growers next Tuesday at the Wavell Showgrounds.
Ron Ramsey there, Chair of the Coalition's Agricultural Policy Committee, and he's also the Federal Member for Grey. It's 12 minutes past 12. Well, the Albanese government yesterday tabled new laws to establish the Biosecurity Protection Levy, intended to raise $50 million from farmers to bankroll activities that assist importers, airlines and other risk creators. Australian farmers say they're stunned by the proposal, but the government says importers, taxpayers and Australia Post will also be contributing funds under the Biosecurity Protection Levy to help protect the nation from biosecurity threats like foot and mouth disease and the varroa mite. Well, farming groups, though, strongly oppose any new tax on producers, as John Daly reports.
Sheena House is a sheep farmer in WA's Great Southern Region. Her flock of 2,000 sheep would be badly affected if a disease like foot and mouth made it into Australia. But the idea of paying a new tax for biosecurity at the border doesn't sit well with her.
Yes, and yeah. I think that's extremely unfair.
It's hard times for WA sheep industry because of subdued prices and a looming phase-out of live sheep exports.
The sheep industry is the worst it's been for years, like forever since I've been married to a farmer. And before I married him, they had to shoot sheep, but it's, you know, nearly got to that stage now because to sell them and get them trucked to market is hardly worth paying the trucking fees, is the reality of lots of farmers. I think it's starting to pick up now, but it's been a horrible year, and it seemed to nosedive when they announced the phase out of the live sheep trade.
The federal government estimates the new levy on producers will add $153 million to the biosecurity bottom line over 3 years from 2024-25. That compares to the estimated $2.3 billion contributed by importers and the general public over those same 3 years. In a statement to PM, Agriculture Minister Murray Watt says if the government's asking teachers, publicans and truckies to pay a bit more for biosecurity, then it's only fair to ask farmers to contribute. That's not how farmers see it, though. National Farmers Federation President David Johinki says they're being bamboozled.
Even the industry importing the goods have suggested that they have capacity to take on these costs. We've seen researchers and people within the industry demonstrate that this is a complex way of gathering additional funding, and the fact that up until this last moment we haven't had any genuine oversight, and even now we're not sure on the makeup of what that oversight is and how it operates, means that this bill needs to be reconsidered. It's just too rushed.
The industry's been pushing for more biosecurity funding and a sustainable biosecurity funding model for years. Can you be accused of making the perfect be the enemy of the good in this situation?
We can be accused of the perfect being the enemy of the good, but we could also be championed for actually highlighting the deficiencies and actually trying to get a better system in place.
Australian National University's Tax and Transfer Policy Institute says that criticism is justified. It's put out a policy briefing, arguing the new levy would unfairly target farmers who aren't responsible for creating the biosecurity risk, or the externality, as policy experts call it. Sasha Vanek is one of the authors.
There's two ways to tax externalities, which is either to tax those who create the externality or to tax everyone who benefits from the avoidance of the externality. And in the case of the levy, they're focusing on just taxing those who derive significant benefits, which has been identified as primary producers, and that doesn't really make sense from a first principles taxation perspective.
Sasha Vanek says a model which only charges importers, travellers and taxpayers for more biosecurity efforts would make more sense. The federal government argues that primary producers benefit a lot more from biosecurity than the average taxpayer. The government also announced today it would establish a sustainable biosecurity funding advisory panel to keep track of the way the new biosecurity funding is being spent.
John Daly with that report. The legislation is now before the House of Representatives, but it is yet to be introduced before the Senate, so still some way to go. Right now, it is 16 minutes past 12. You're with Selena Green on the Country Hour. Well, keeping an eye on your cattle or your sheep can be tough work, especially for older farmers working across large properties. But a drone photographer in Victoria says he's developed a world-first app that can take the hard work out of counting and monitoring livestock. Edward Barraclough hit upon the idea when his father, who's in his 80s and has no plan to leave the farm, asked if there was a way to watch his sheep from the skies. Fiona Broom went to find out how it all works.
We've designed it so that the farmer just needs to take the drone outside, turn it on, choose his paddock and press go. The drone takes off by itself, flies out over the paddock, videos all of the animals there, and at the same time tells you immediately how many you've got, where they are, and if any are in trouble.
This is Edward Barraclough. Edward's a drone photographer, and he's showing me his latest venture, a drone-controlled livestock monitoring app. It's driven by artificial intelligence, and Edward reckons when it hits the market, it'll be the world's first drone livestock monitor.
At the moment, we've built that AI model. We've done a whole lot of customer research and validation. I've been through a few pre-accelerator courses with a group called Farmers to Founders. They're supported by Launch Vic and a few other of the government-funded initiatives. They've been a fantastic help to help teach me all the things I need to know about startups. Right now, we're working with developers here in Melbourne to integrate the AI model into the flight control app. That should be ready in a few months, and as soon as that's ready, we'll be ready to launch. I've done about more than 300 interviews with customers to confirm all of this. We've got early adopters in a few states now, and we're looking forward to having a really exciting launch. Now, I just popped one of these drones up. When we use this for the animals, I generally fly it about 100 metres up, and that way the animals tend not to react at all. They don't seem to notice it. But you will notice as it takes off, it's a little loud. And so that's at about, it's only about 5 metres or so up, but you can still hear it quite loud. But as soon as they go up a bit higher, and that's just at 50 metres now, and so you can barely hear it.
Yeah, that just would blend in with regular farm noises, wouldn't it?
But then if I go up to 100 metres where we use the drone hand software, you almost can't hear it at all. And so that's...
Almost can't see it either.
Yeah. At that point, the sheep don't tend to notice. They don't react. The same with the cattle next door and things like that as well.
And so how did you come to create this software?
As I said, I've been a drone photographer, an aerial photographer for a little while now, and I've used all types of different programs with it. My dad works, has a farm up in New South Wales, and I was up there one day taking some photos with a drone. He's in his mid-80s. He looked over my shoulder and said, you know, if you could check the sheep for me with that, I could stay on the farm longer. Because at his age, you know, getting around, just trying to open the gates, drive around up and down the hills to check the sheep is not the easiest thing in the world. Now, I'd used plenty of different programs for mapping and surveying, and I knew there were agricultural programs for cropping, and I thought there had to be something for animals. So I looked into it, and the further I looked, I saw that there really wasn't. There wasn't any autonomous systems built for monitoring livestock. After a lot of research and looking into it, I got in touch with a machine learning engineer out of Sydney University, and together we built the AI model. And from there, it's been a real slog to try and do customer validation and make sure that it is something that the market can support and get the technology going. And it's looking like we'll be ready to launch in a few months, and all going well, we'll be the first to market.
How much work is involved in counting your flock or counting your herd? Have you heard from producers that this will be a time saver for them?
Yeah, that's right. Generally, I mean, it depends on the size of your property and the terrain and things like that, but you'd be spending a minimum of an hour or more, up to, you know, 3 or 4 hours, depending on where you are, just getting into the ute or the buggy, going out, opening, closing gates, getting through the paddocks. I've taken this around to quite a number of different farmers around the place, and their general response has been initially, oh, drones, I'm not too sure about that. But once I show them what it looks like to look down on the property and look down at the animals, they're like, wow, that's amazing. I could, you know, that could save me so much time. I could do so many other things if I could just send it off from my house. So yeah, generally it's likely to save quite a lot of time and money in staffing costs.
And in terms of getting to grips with the technology and how to use the software and the program, is it something that would take a lot of time to learn?
Not really, because we've tried to make it as user-friendly as possible. We've tried to make it as autonomous as possible. So basically all the farmer needs to do is on their computer to define the boundaries of their paddocks. That then automatically goes to the app that controls the drone. And then all you need to do is take the drone outside, turn it on, choose your paddock and your livestock, whether it's sheep or cattle, and press go. The drone takes off, flies a route that is predetermined, comes back and tells you instantly how many sheep and or cattle you've got, where they are, and if any have any issues.
Farmers do sometimes have a reputation for being a bit tech averse, but I love that it was your dad, who's in his 80s, who said, can you write me a software for that?
Yeah, exactly. It's a funny misconception. We have a view of farmers as being tech averse and sort of being against anything new. But actually, agriculture is the largest adopter of new tech of any industry. But they have to know that it works, that you have to show them that it works.
Yeah. So we do hear often about farm crime, about livestock theft, and we hear that one of the difficulties with farm crime is if you have 20 sheep or 40 sheep taken out of the flock, you might not know about it for a couple of months, by which time the police don't really have anything to go on. Could you see this being beneficial in any way to sort of stemming some of that livestock theft?
Yeah, exactly. And that was something that I, even though I come from an ag background, it's something that I hadn't truly appreciated how severe it's become in the last few years. DroneHand is definitely built for that purpose as well, to help stem some of the losses through livestock theft and general animal mortality. Just being able to have an accurate count, an accurate number of how many animals you have, like you said, if 30 go missing, you may not notice or really realise at ground level when they're spread out over a very large paddock. But with this, you'll know every couple of days exactly how many you've got and where they are.
That's Edward Barraclough there. He's the founder of DroneHand Livestock Monitoring, the app, and he was speaking there to Fiona Broom.
Here's my top footy tip for the season. You can get your games live and ad-free on the ABC Listen app.
That's insightful!
I know, right? AFL, NRL, men's, women's. Whatever footy you're after, we've got you covered.
Kicks it on the road, he does, he bounces it through. every goal, try, mark and tackle. Called by ABC Sports expert commentary team.
How did he do it? Game, set, bingo!
This season on the home of 100% pure footy, the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
It's that time of the day. We need to head to the Weather Bureau and our forecaster today, Mark Anilak. Hello.
Good afternoon, Selena.
And hopefully things have settled down quite a bit from that pretty nasty weather we had yesterday.
Yeah, the change has now moved into the far north of the state. So we've still got this trough lingering about northern parts. Pretty uncomfortable conditions, I would think, across the northern border there with dew point temperatures up around 20 degrees and actual temperatures getting up to close to 40. So it must be pretty humid up sort of Moomba Way and Oodnadatta. South of the trough line, southerly winds are bringing milder conditions to agricultural areas and the south of the pastoral districts. We did see a little bit of thunderstorm activity yesterday afternoon, and through the northern Flinders ranges, I think we had a few millimetres there. Andamooka had 2.2 millimetres, so there were a couple of places around there that had sort of less than a few millimetres from those thunderstorms. As we speak, we still have a heatwave warning out for northwest pastoral district. There's still a lot of hot air over the northern parts of the state. The good news is, with this cooler southerly wind pushing up from the south, we'll eventually break that heat and we'll lose that heatwave warning through the northern parts of the state in the next sort of 48 hours. Tomorrow, the combination of this very hot, humid air moving down from Northern Territory into the north, the trough line still sitting there, we're likely to see showers and thunderstorms building across the north of the state. We could even see some severe thunderstorms about the northwest pastoral district and the northern Flinders ranges as well during tomorrow afternoon and evening. And those severe thunderstorms could have heavy rainfall leading to flash flooding and maybe even some damaging wind gusts as well. But most of the weather will hover around the pastoral and Flinders districts tomorrow. Agricultural areas will again be mostly dry and partly cloudy in this cooler southerly wind regime. Through the weekend, Saturday into Sunday, the southerly winds continue to push northwards and it pushes the shower and thunderstorm activity further north. So Saturday we can still see some showers and thunderstorms about pastoral districts. By Sunday they're sort of just moving to the far north and northeast and northwest corner. But the rest of the state should be pretty much dry and temperatures again near or slightly below average temperatures for this time of year, given the winds are still remaining southerly. Looking ahead to the early part of next week, a main high pressure system will drift over to the Tasman. So winds, as they always do, start to move northerly and will start to drag some of the warmer air down over the state. So warmer conditions for the early part of next week and an increase in fire danger ratings as well, I would suspect. In terms of rainfall amounts, very hit and miss stuff, nature of this thunderstorm activity. So isolated showers and thunderstorms probably producing less than a couple of millimetres across the pastoral, or the north and west, the pastoral districts, Flinders and maybe even the west coast. There might be areas of 2 to 10 millimetres, but that really is highly dependent on where these thunderstorms form. And for tomorrow and Saturday, those severe thunderstorms may produce very localised falls of the order of 10 to 30 millimetres with each of those thunderstorms. So in short, Selena, still a couple of unsettled days across the north for the next 48 hours or so, but things are gradually easing, and through the latter part of the weekend and early next week, we'll see mainly sort of settled conditions for the early part of next week.
All right, good to hear. Thanks for that, Mark. Have a great rest of your day.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Mark Anilak there from the Weather Bureau. Well, the forecast for the western inland parts of New South Wales for tomorrow, both the upper and western district are expecting a mostly sunny day with a slight chance of a shower and the chance of a thunderstorm as well, most likely to arrive in the afternoon and into the evening. For the upper western district, light winds becoming northwest to southwesterlies, 15 to 20 k's now in the morning, tending south southeast to southwesterly in the evening. For the lower western district, starting out with light winds, and they'll become south to southwesterlies around 15 to 25 k's now by the late afternoon. Overnight temperatures, they'll get down to between 19 and 24 degrees in the lower western district. A little bit warmer overnight for the upper western district. They could be more closer to the mid to high 20s. For the day, though, both districts expecting temperatures to reach around 40 degrees. It's coming up to 12:30 here on the Country Hour. Coming up, a big day for the state's timber industry and for timber manufacturing. The launch of a brand new facility making timber panels that can be used to build high-rise timber buildings.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Selena Green. Selena Green.
Good afternoon. I'm going to get you to take a listen to this sound. See if you can figure out what it is you're listening to here. That is the sound of an idling B-double truck, fully loaded with logs. And you're thinking, that sounds a bit quiet for a B-double. Well, it's not just any truck. Australia's first electric truck. It's been trialled by a southeast forestry company, and they've just been granted some state government funding to further that trial, which you'll hear more about shortly. And in a moment, I'll cross live to the launch of another Australian first. It's the country's first factory producing timber panels for high-rise buildings out of a couple of innovative products. And it is located right here in South Australia. That's also to come. But first, let's go to Matt Coleman, and he's got your headlines. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, a male pedestrian has suffered serious injuries after being hit by a truck at the Royal Australian Air Force Base in Adelaide's north. Police and emergency services were called to West Avenue at Edinburgh about 8:15 this morning. West Avenue runs through a defence technology precinct, and police say the crash occurred on the base itself. Investigations are underway into a potentially suspicious house fire in Adelaide's west. The property on Palmyra Avenue at Torrensville was engulfed in flames when firefighters were called about midnight. The damage bill is estimated to be about $600,000. And Port Adelaide has decided not to appeal against Sam Powell Pepper's 4-game suspension for rough conduct against Adelaide defender Mark Keane in an AFL practice match. Powell Pepper was hit with the ban by the AFL Tribunal yesterday for his bump on Keane in the first term of the match last Friday. The club says it will also not apply for Powell Pepper to play in tomorrow's Community Series pre-season match against Fremantle. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman there with your headlines. Now, there's an important ribbon-cutting event happening in the state's southeast as we speak. It's the official opening of an Australian first timber mill in the small town of Tarpina, which is around 20 minutes north of Mount Gambier. The site is now home to the country's first radiata pine cross-laminated timber, CLT, and glue-laminated timber, GLT. It's the first manufacturing facility making both of those products, producing large timber panels that can be used in homes to high-rise buildings. It's being officially opened by the Premier and has been built by the company Next Timber, who've poured millions into expanding the site with the latest technology. Our reporter Elsie Adamo is there for the event, so let's cross to her in Tarpina now. Good afternoon, Elsie.
Good afternoon, Selena. Yes, it's been a very busy day at Tarpina today. The Timberlink Next Timber facility was officially opened, and they even invited 300 people on site for the event, the largest amount of people they've ever had here. So I've been lucky enough with 160 others to get a tour of the facility, and the Premier's been here as well, and it's all been very exciting. So this is an $160 million project, and that's $90 million on a new green saw line, $70 million on the cross-laminated timber and glue-laminated timber making facilities. I'm joined by David Oliver, Chief Marketing, Sales and Corporate Affairs Officer for Timberlink. Good afternoon, David.
Good afternoon, and thanks so much for coming, and I hope you enjoyed your tour here today.
So interesting. Yes, it's hard to explain on radio the scale of this news facility.
Yes, it's very large, 15,000 square metres. The overall site here is 40 hectares, so you will have got your steps up, no doubt, through the course of the tour. But we're very excited to have the Premier here today and the Minister for Agriculture. Very exciting to see their level of interest and their enthusiasm about this facility. It's a great asset for South Australia.
So CLT and GLT, why has it been such a big investment to start making it, and what can it be used for?
Big investment, 15,000 square metre facility, lots of equipment as you've seen, very big scaled facility so that we can compete internationally. The products are used, cross-laminated timber is used for walls, stairs, roofs, in building skyscrapers essentially, and GLT is used to replace steel in beams and lintels and columns, and also can be used in residential houses for things like garage lintels and heavy loads.
So where are you planning to be shipping this to? Where are the orders going to be coming from, David?
We've been supplying the glue laminated beam since October through our customers throughout Australia. We supplied our first project, which was in Sydney, in January. We've got some very exciting projects in the pipeline and in the coming months, particularly some very exciting projects in Adelaide.
And are you at capacity, or is there still a lot of room to grow as more orders come in?
I know we're certainly far from capacity. We think it'll take 2 to 3 years to actually ramp to capacity. The exciting thing is that builders all over Australia are actually embracing buildings that actually sequester carbon. Timber is the ultimate renewable building product.
Yes, I was going to ask, are you really going to have to educate builders that this product is Australia-made and available now?
Yes, well, we've got quite a lot of interest, and we've got some builders and engineers that have been through the facility today, and they were very impressed. And it is an education, and it's something we've been working on. In fact, one of the exciting projects in Adelaide we've been working on for over 2 years. It's a long life cycle. You design the buildings in a CAD model, and then we actually take those designs and actually output them to a really big router in the factory that can route the panels, which we can manufacture for cross-laminated timber up to 16 metres long, 3.5 metres wide and 450 mil thick.
New workers needed to do all this work, I imagine.
Yes, certainly employment and seeking to find new employees in regional Australia can be a challenge, but we've actually found there's been a very high level of interest. So there's 27 new employees for the next timber facility here in Tarpina. We expect that to grow over time to 50 as we scale the facility and builders embrace building in this sustainable way.
What's been the journey to this moment, 5 years in the making? How's it feel it's now actually happening?
Oh, look, it's been very exciting for the Premier to officially open the site today. It has been a five-year journey. We started by building Australia's newest green saw line here in Tarpina. It was a $90 million investment. And that was a big challenge. We built that through COVID, and we commissioned some of the equipment via Teams with people in the US, which you would never have imagined doing before. And the cross-laminated, glue-laminated plant, we actually broke ground in 2021. So it's been a long time coming out of the ground, and those that drive on the Panola Road through Tarpina will no doubt have seen it. It's hard to miss, 15,000 square metres, but we're very excited to have opened it today.
And you're able to find enough supplies for your production? Are they all coming locally?
Yes, all our timber supply comes from the Green Triangle throughout the region. And as we talked about this morning, one of the great things about this is timber from this region has always been used to build homes and pallets and the like. We're now going to actually supply product into commercial buildings. Those commercial buildings tend to be on a different cycle to the residential housing cycle. So the regions enjoyed the boom, as we saw through the demand spike of COVID. Housing starts going to be a little bit challenging over the next couple of years. So this gives us an opportunity to take timber from the Green Triangle and put it into skyscrapers all over Australia.
So as I said earlier, 300 people on site today. You mentioned they're coming from all over the country and even overseas.
Yes, they are. We've got we've had today people from Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, of course, South Australia, Western Australia, and Tassie. Also from New Zealand. This is a unique site internationally, so there's a lot of excitement about it. In fact, we have a gentleman coming from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in the next couple of weeks to come and view the facility with the intent of collaborating on projects in that country.
Yes, I was going to say, so what, there might be some orders from Saudi Arabia in the future?
Well, we hope so. Some of these projects have got a long life cycle. It takes sort of 2 to 3 years from when you start to supply. So we hope we can see our timber being used in other parts of the world. It's project driven, so it can be a little bit lumpy, but we've got lots and lots of capacity. So if any of your listeners want to build a timber skyscraper, we're more than happy to talk to them.
Thank you for your time this afternoon, David.
Thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed the day.
It has been a very enjoyable day for sure. So that was David Oliver, Chief Marketing Sales and Corporate Affairs Officer for Timberlink. Yes, Selena, lots and lots happening. Mm. It is so amazing to see so many workers active, so many people really interested in what's happening here. I wonder how long it will be before we see a wooden skyscraper made out of timber made right here in Tarpina in Adelaide.
Yeah, that would be a good question, isn't it? How long will it take? Thank you, Elsie. That is Elsie Adamo, and she's reporting to us there from the official opening of the next timber CLT and GLT plant in Tarpina. You are with Selena Green on the South Australian Country Hour. It's just going on 20 minutes to one. But as you heard, the Premier, Peter Malinauskas, is in the southeast for the official opening of that new timber plant. But before he headed there, he stopped at a pine plantation near Mount Gambier earlier today to launch a new South Australian wood fibre and timber industry master plan. That plan aims to grow and develop the state's $1.4 billion forest and timber industry, including domestic manufacturing. It also includes a couple of funding announcements, such as $200,000 investment in Fennell Forestry to start phase two of a trial of an electric log truck. The company has been testing Australia's first electric heavy vehicle. I headed out a short time ago as we had the chance to see the electric truck in action, and I had a chance to speak to the Premier about where forestry fitted within the plan to decarbonise South Australia.
Well, forestry has a massive role to play because we know it's an industry of the future, not least of which because the world demands fibre and actually can contribute towards decarbonisation. And one of the things that comes out of our forestry master plan is a serious commitment to capitalise on that opportunity. We're here today announcing a $200,000 funding of Fennell Forestry be able to go into a second phase of their trial on electric haulage of forestry. And we can hear that in the background as we speak. It's a lot quieter than a diesel truck.
Absolutely. Plan is one thing. Obviously, funding to make a plan happen. And we've talked about a couple of projects that are initially being funded in this. Further down the track, what about things like incentives for the industry to grow plantations, for the actual resource to grow here within the state? Do you see a role within government for that?
Yes, we do have a responsibility. That is quiet, isn't it?
Wow.
It is impressive, I've got to say. So, yes, is the short answer to your question. As a government, we're not just talking about forestry being important. We're actually putting our money where our mouth is, whether it be funding of the master plan, $200,000 to a private company driving electric trucks we see going off in front of us, or whether it be more long-term, and that's where we're committed to the Forestry Centre of Excellence. That is year-on-year funding into the future to actually find the opportunities in fibre production and use that can actually not just contribute to decarbonisation, but contribute to the overall productivity of this economy.
That is the Premier, Peter Malinauskas. And yes, we were standing next to an electric B-double fully loaded with logs that started up and drove off as we did that interview. So anyone who's been close to a diesel B-double truck, and I've grown up around them my whole life, it is quite startling, the difference in volume with the noise. At that launch, I also spoke with the Forest Industries Minister, Claire Scriven, about the work that's gone into this new plan for the state's timber industry.
So before coming to government, we undertook to do a master plan for the whole forest and timber products industry. It's really important that we know the future directions of the industry and that we are equipped to be able to grasp those opportunities. We know how important it is to the Limestone Coast in particular. We want to make sure that we have things like the right workforce, we have the right capability, we have the right resource, and of course the clean, green, circular economy is also incredibly important to that. So they're the themes that were developed through the master plan process, and now we're able to start implementing some of the projects that support those themes. So it's a huge opportunity for the industries going forward, and it's really important that we're able to join together across the entire supply chain and across all of the sectors and stakeholders to develop a plan like this.
And a big day, because once you leave this site, you're heading north to Tarpina, just down the road, for the official opening of the next timber project there. How significant is this for the state to have a facility like this up and running?
Well, this is unique in Australia in that it's both a CLT and a GLT plant co-located with the existing manufacturing facility. So this enables the diversification of products. It enables higher rise buildings based on timber products, which in itself means that those buildings are more sustainable. So this is a huge opportunity for our region as well as for our state. So the benefits are local. There's an extra 27 full-time jobs that have been created ongoing. There's the additional product that's going to be available, but the importance to our state is also huge. It's a great achievement, and congratulations to Timberlink.
And we've talked about timber, obviously the focus of today, but also within the ag industry, fisheries is in your portfolio. And we know in the last few days we've had some not great news about the movement of an abalone virus into southeast waters. What can you tell me about the response and how concerned you are to hear that that has now reached our state?
So this is a virus, AVG, that's been in Victoria for quite a number of years, but this is the first time it's been detected here in South Australia. I've been really pleased with the support that has come from both commercial fishers and recreational fishers around the exclusion zone. So we've had to have that zone from Nene Valley through to the Victorian border, and that is to ensure that the virus is not further spread through human activity. We can't control it being spread through natural causes, but we can control human activity, which could increase the spread. Just today, we've been able to announce that those who have lobster pots in the zone will be able to go and collect those pots. They'll need to register to do so, and then they'll need to essentially disinfect all of their boats, their gear, and so on. They can go to the PIRZA website to find out more about that. But it's really important for the abalone industry locally, and I'm really pleased that people have been so willing to cooperate in what is a difficult time.
As the Primary Industries Minister, Claire Scriven. So a small slice of good news there for rock lobster fishers whose pots are located in that no fishing zone off the Port Macdonald coast, where the AVG virus has been detected in wild abalone. And PIRZA has just sent out some further details a moment ago on how they're facilitating that process. They say they have been in contact with licence and registration holders, but more details available on that PIRZA website around how the retrieval process for those pots can and must take place. And just a reminder that there is a ban on all fishing activities from shore or boat, which extends from the Victorian border along the South Australian coast to Nene Valley and 10 kilometres or 4-5 nautical miles out to sea to prevent further spread of that AVG virus by human activity. Back to this electric truck trial that I mentioned earlier. Well, here's what the Chief Executive of Fennel Forestry, Wendy Fennel, had to say about how it's all going.
Stage two of the electric truck. I'm really looking forward to working with the government on this. Decarbonisation will be a long, slow road, especially for the heavy vehicle transport, but this is the steps that we've had to take to establish how we're going to get to, how we're going to meet those net zero targets. So the first stage was about working out if this technology is operationally suitable. And that's what we've established over the last 12 months. The next stage is working through what is the policy and the framework and the financial sustainability of decarbonising the transport and using electric vehicles in this specific transport task to achieve those results. So thank you very much to the government for coming on board to support this. Industry is able to provide solutions to government, but it needs to be a partnership in how we do achieve decarbonising our industry.
That's the Chief Executive of Fennel Forestry there, Wendy Fennel. And it's just going on 12 minutes to one.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, no one wants to get injured at work. or worse. We all want to come home nice and safe at the end of the day. Well, for many farmers, work and home are one and the same. But a recent report has been released outlining the number of on-farm deaths and injuries recorded in the last year. And in 2023, 32 deaths occurred on farming properties across Australia. Farm Safety Research Manager at Ag Health Australia, Kerry Lynch-Peachy, says that while it's a reduction in numbers from the previous year, work must continue to ensure safety is paramount.
The main causes we're seeing are tractors and quad bikes. They still continue to be the leading cause of death across Australia, which is very unfortunate. And we are now that we are starting to also see side-by-side vehicles come into play, and a majority of these are because people are not wearing the seatbelts that are fitted within the vehicle.
What sort of work is going on in this space at the moment?
Look, there's lots going on. You know, there's research, development efforts that are focusing on farm safety campaigns. There's regulations and enforcement. New South Wales have been lucky to have financial incentives to put in safety products. For example, the fitment of operator protection devices to quad bikes, or changing to a safer vehicle with the purchase of a side-by-side vehicle. Awareness campaigns, training, education.
What can be done sort of going forward to, you know, really bring down those numbers and make sure that at the end of the day these farmers are returning home to their families?
Well, look, safety, it's not just the responsibility of the individual manager worker. You know, it requires a coordinated effort from everybody within the agricultural industry. So whether that's the farmers, the industry organisation, government agencies or the wider community, we need to work together through research, education and advocacy, you know, to ensure that everybody comes home at the end of the day. And by doing this, we will reduce the impact of farm-related incidents.
And are you seeing a certain sort of age group that is more susceptible to these incidents?
Look, as identified in the report, a lot of them are over 50, more half of them are over 50 years of age. And look, that is probably in sync because the average age of a farmer is now approaching 58 to 59 years. So that's probably why, because they're much more have higher exposure within the industry.
Do you think that there's more in terms of what people can do personally in terms of wearing helmets and that sort of thing? Does that really need to ramp up?
Oh, look, absolutely. Safety has to come second nature, like in our everyday life. It's just like you know, for example, you get in the car and you put your seatbelt on, but you do it without even thinking about it. So this is what we've got to get trying to get safety to do. So, you know, when you approach a machine, you think, well, okay, oh, that task I'm doing today, is that going to be the most safest, you know, vehicle I could use, for example? Or that piece of machinery that I'm using, is all its guards in place to protect me? You know, is everything in good working order? Because I need to ensure that I'm going to be safe while I undertake that task.
And are these the sort of things that need to be, you know, drummed into kids and from a young age?
Oh, look, definitely. You know, we as parents or we as farm managers, whatever it be, a lot of kids do, whether they live on the farm or whether they visit the farm, managers and farmers have to lead by example. So we have to be wearing our helmets on a quad bike. We have to be wearing our seatbelts in the farm vehicles or the side-by-side. So we need to lead by example, because if we don't lead by example, the kids will not follow.
Are there certain areas in the agricultural industry that are more susceptible to these on-farm incidents?
Look, no, I think they're all sparse different industries. There's no certain industry that sort of stands out. Yes, there's all different industries across Australia.
Working with the University of Sydney, is there more research, you know, going on in this space at the moment?
Yes, definitely. We're looking at present time, we're actually looking at mortality and morbidity within farmers. So they're looking at things like cancers, diseases and different things within farmers. So that is currently undergoing at the moment. So that will be another targeted program that will come out at the end of those results from that study. We're also looking at dementia in farming now, because it's starting to become a little bit prevalent within the farming industry. So, yeah, things are changing, as, like, you know, there's always work being done on mental health. So, yeah, it's an evolving space with things going on all the time.
That is the Farm Safety Research Manager with Ag Health Australia, Kerry Lynch-Peachy, and she was speaking there with Lily McCure. Well, finally today, all sorts of feral animals are having a significant negative impact on the natural ecosystems of regional Australia. In the north of our state, feral goats tear up the soil with their hard hooves, which are not suited to our landscape, compared to the soft paws of native kangaroos and wallabies. The state government has identified control of feral goats as a priority, allocating more than $300,000 to the SA Arid Lands Landscape Board for this purpose. SA Arid Lands Landscape Board General Manager Jody Gregg-Smith told Tom Mann about the challenge that they face.
The South Australian Arid Lands Landscape Board covers more than 50% of South Australia, predominantly the outback, everything north of Port Augusta, up to the Northern Territory, Queensland, New South Wales borders, and then we connect either side with other South Australian landscape boards. So we got a bit of dirt to look after. Putting an exact number on it is difficult. Animals are moving in and out of the space at all the time, and also are being mustered off by landholders to go to market and the like. So, but it's fair to say there are tens or hundreds of thousands of goats or the risk of that number if we don't get ahead of it or on top of it.
How did goats come to take up so much space in our state?
They're a very transient animal. They move like a lot of the feral herbivores nationally. You know, that would include camels, goat, donkeys, horses and the like. Goats are fairly densely populated south of the dog fence in South Australia, and at a point in time they've been farmed. What's happened, because they're great breeders and a few good conditions seasonally, their populations will explode, as well as the fact that they can survive on pretty much nothing. Their populations can grow in a significant way after a couple of good seasons like what we've just had.
So is this a little bit of, you know, historic carelessness from landholders who are farming goats?
Not necessarily, and certainly in the pastoral zone, which our board particularly looks after, the landholders are typically pretty good. They will muster them off because goats are a great protein. They make it to the plate. They're exported. The meat is exported internationally. So typically pastoralists are terrific at mustering them off as an opportunistic income and as a way to reduce the grazing impact where they typically are running cattle or sheep. So it's not a case of a fault particular to anyone. It's everyone's responsibility to manage feral animals, and this is one of the ways that we've managed them typically. What we find ourselves facing at the moment is the market for goat has really dropped and substantially. While that doesn't earn as much for landholders, they still have a duty and responsibility to muster them off or deal with them because they are out competing their stock for pasture as well as destroying habitat at a rate that's really quite concerning.
Jody Gregg-Smith is with me, General Manager of the SA Arid Lands Landscape Board, speaking about controlling feral goat populations in the north of our state. And so what are some of the other impacts that feral goats are having?
Because they are really clever at getting into spaces, really high range country, as well as in and out of really sensitive places where endangered and threatened species might seek refuge or might have habitat, goats can very, very rapidly destroy habitat for other native species. Equally, they can foul up waterways, natural and man-made. And the thing is they do eat so much of the native vegetation. They also eat the ground cover as well as canopy cover, which means they can denude an area very, very quickly, which is pretty concerning. We've got some amazing natural values in our region and cultural values. Our board, in partnership with many others, seek to protect that. But where the numbers of goats become so significant that they are taking these habitats past the point of return, we've really got an obligation to do something significant about that, which is why we've applied for some extra resourcing to throw behind it.
And your organisation has been allocated just over $300,000 for a statewide rangelands goat management strategy project. Can you talk about, what this money will be allocated towards, how it will be used to control the populations?
Certainly. So this application, which we won through the State Landscape Priorities Fund, is to put some additional resources to coordinating the effort. We're working in partnership with all of our neighbouring landscape boards, including the Eyre Peninsula, Northern and York, Murraylands and Riverland landscape boards, so that at a landscape scale, where goats happen to move and exist, we can tackle it at a significant scope. This position, or this funding for our board, will be funding a position that will support a really integrated approach to managing goats, not just for harvesting them commercially so that we can get more goat meat on the plate and in butcher shops, but also looking at alternative novel ways to make sure that we're not wasting a protein by just culling the animal. We're also leveraging significant funding to do control and management on the ground that will complement the coordinating effort of the role that we'll be soon recruiting for, that is a state goat manager, to work with policymakers, landholders, industry and other partners to try and get ahead of this issue, particularly as we contemplate going into a drier period at any point in the future.
That is the General Manager of the SA Arid Lands Landscape Board, Jodie Gregg-Smith, and she was speaking there to Tom Mann. Only yesterday on the program we were hearing about this campaign to encourage people to eat more goat meat and try and get it more onto more restaurant menus and into butcher shops as well. So it looks like there is a resource available there. That's almost it for me for today. Thanks so much for your company. Deb Tribe will be with you again for the afternoon's program today. She'll be looking at the cost of broccoli. Have you noticed what the cost of broccoli is lately? Is it putting you off your broccoli? And she'll also be talking about living your whole life in one suburb. So maybe if you're someone who hasn't moved around a whole lot, she'll be very keen to hear from you. I'll be keen to hear from you tomorrow. I'll be back then for more Country Hour. It's 1 o'clock.
To get started with the ABC Listen app, find the App Store on your phone. Search for ABC Listen, tap the pink ABC Listen icon and download it. Congratulations, now you've got ABC Radio in your pocket.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.